On today's show, a conversation about Ayurvedic health. We also learn about two women of different life circumstances, yet equally offering big ideas to the world. But first, contributing producer Anessa Anderson chats with Jana Lopez. Jana has been in media, marketing, communications, business development, and branding for the past 25 years. And as one door closed for her, many more opened as she navigated a really dark time in her life. But that led her to some really powerful life changes that included joy and accomplishment.
Homework.
Homework? What's homework?
I have a paper. I'm finishing school, my undergrad degree.
Oh, still. Okay.
So I got to walk in my graduation ceremony 2 weeks ago, and I still have 3 classes to finish. I'm halfway through, and once I'm done, I will be graduated.
Jana Lopez, it's wonderful to have you here.
It's so great to be here.
We were reminiscing about a lot of things before we sat down to actually talk, and I'm trying to recall how it is that that you came into my life, and you were running a couple of different magazines.
Yes.
Goodness, and the other one,
Portland Family.
Portland Family.
Mm-hmm.
Things have changed a lot. The digital world has come to life in such a strong way that I just feel like a lot of magazines can't really exist anymore.
I think I probably would have been fine. I would have kept bumping along. I mean, I think magazines still definitely have a place. It just has to do with relevance and storytelling. I mean, I think people go online for news, but I don't think people necessarily always go online for stories, at least if they want something more than 140 characters.
Something more in depth that they can sit down with.
And, I think so.
Yeah, because I know that a lot of the, you know, the daily papers have, you know, had to do the digital switch.
And it's over. News. I get it.
Uh-huh.
I do. But like I read a story the other month that The Atlantic had published, and it was such a beautiful, moving story. I know 100% I would not have appreciated that story or enjoyed that story if I read it online. I had to have it in the magazine with the photos, the way it was presented.
Yeah.
So it's not for all publications, and it's not everybody's choice, but I think there is still a place for certain publications and for some people.
Yeah, and I think that I very quickly discovered that the New York Times was way ahead of that curve. They really, really were working on securing their position as a digital brand as well.
Right. And their print products that they do have are still valued as their print products.
Yeah. I do the Weekender, but the Sunday paper still is an old New York. It's
right.
It's a hangover.
It
Not
is.
A hangover from tequila, but like a holdover, I guess.
Right. Holdover, mean. Hangover.
What's the difference?
Right.
There is no difference. Yeah, it's definitely a holdover. I remember my favorite thing was on a Sunday, you know, with given boyfriend, you know, we'd be in bed drinking coffee.
Coffee.
And the New York Times.
Right.
So it is still a happening thing. I don't drink that and read it in my bed, but I come out here onto my couch. So that's changed, I guess. You know, some things have changed. So moving on from that, so you were the owner, the publisher, the
right.
chief bottle cook and bottle washer, basically.
I call it CEO to janitor and everything in between.
Yeah, it's that kind of a job when you have a big undertaking like that. But you did you sell it? Did you just what made you decide, okay, that's it for me on that count?
Yeah, and this is kind of a quick heartbreaking story. I did end up selling it, and I sold it not because I didn't love the work or didn't love the purpose of it. I really felt like I had taken it to the furthest point it could go within my own capacity. So the person that I sold it to, I had a belief that it would have the means and resources to flourish beyond me. And it didn't turn out. It ended up being a legal situation that went on for 2 years that was very unpleasant and kind of a turning point in my life.
And I think that it's like you have to look at the things that make us suffer is what makes us strong.
Right. You know, it's a midlife thing. I won't call it a crisis. Lately, I've been reading about the dark night of the soul and what that is and the difference between depression and a dark night. And I think when you reach a point in your middle age, whatever that is, or even at some point in your life where everything that you know, your foundation starts to get pulled out from beneath you. And it's not something that we talk about publicly. certainly not on Facebook, but a lot of reevaluation. It's been very difficult, and I'm on the upswing of that, but the publication was very much part of my identity.
And that was in 2014.
Right.
So what? So that happened, and it wasn't an easy discharge of the ownership.
No.
But moving on from that, where was the next corner for you?
Well, I think the next corner was wandering around in the desert for a while. I didn't really have an answer, and I'm not exactly sure I still don't. I don't think I have that answer yet even. I'm working. I'm doing publications for other people, and I'm creating publications for schools, and it's lovely. I love the work. I love telling people stories. I love helping other people tell their stories. I'm doing some work for Metro East Community Media and freelancing, doing some stories for the Oregonian for their special section. So, I mean, I have work. And I have a hint of a next project about doing a book.
So before we get to that,
right,
let's keep everyone in suspense. Where did Merrillhurst come in? When did you, how did you say, okay, I need to get back and re-educate?
That's a good question. And I think this is an important one for anybody to hear who has ever thought about going back to school. I was a terrible student. I was in and out and on and off of City College. When I got my transcripts, I saw it was for 12 years. I think I laughed at myself and cried at the same time that who the hell goes to City College on and off for 12 years? I was a bad student. It took me a long time. I didn't get serious about school until I was in my 30s. I went to PSU. I had a full scholarship for diversity, having a Hispanic and Jewish background and whatever. So I got serious about school and I was getting good grades. And then I had a year to finish, and that's when I had my daughter. So
that changed everything, upended everything, right?
That's it. I was pregnant up until, you know, practically in summer session until I gave birth. And then I never thought I needed school because school is always equated to a career, to a financial outcome. And I was always what I felt like was pretty successful. I was making a living being self-employed. That's my definition of success. So I thought, why would I go and spend money and go in debt and go through all that when I'm doing very well? But then when I started going through this sort of what's next, pity me, poor me, I was very upset and very lost. I had a friend who was going to Merrillhurst who was getting so much out of her education. Internally, she was evolving and I could see it. She was changing and shifting. And I thought, okay, I'll just see how much time I have left. So I got my credits evaluated and they said, oh, you only have a year. I'm like, well, if I don't.
City College was where?
Santa Monica City College.
Oh, okay.
So they evaluated my credits and they said, you only had a year left. And I thought, well, I can't not go back to school.
Are you originally from Santa Monica?
LA. Yeah.
Okay. LA.
Born and raised. Mm-hmm. Been here 20 years. It's my home. Don't tell me to go back. And so I thought, you know what? I can't not go back and finish school if I only have a year. So they were very generous with their scholarships. I was very impressed with their campus, very impressed with...
It's beautiful.
Yeah, and they were so good to me. I was terrified. And my admissions person was so kind. She literally held my hand every time I had a breakdown when I had to fill out an application or something. And she literally held my hand and... So I just decided I was going to go back and finish.
And what did you finish in?
An interdisciplinary degree because all of my credits were in English. So I thought, well, I'd better, you know, apply them as best as I can. It would have taken me a little bit longer with an English degree. So
right. That's my degree. Theater and English both right. Really helpful, aren't they?
Right. So
in some degrees they are.
I got to walk in the graduation ceremony a few weeks ago in June. And I still had a couple of classes to finish up in summer, but I will be done here at the end of August. So by the time this is airing, I will be officially graduated.
That sounds like you're probably going through senior blues or whatever it's called. That thing that happens when you've got your last couple of weeks.
You know, I'm not feeling blue. The thing that's so interesting, this is what I would want to convey to people who think about going back to school and wonder what's the point. when I was in that graduation ceremony, I felt such an elation and joy and connection and satisfaction. Not that I had accomplished something or I had done something, but I felt part of something that I never knew I wanted or needed. And it was unlike any experience I've ever had, nothing to compare it with. It was beautiful. I loved it. I had such a great day that day. And I you know, even though I had a few classes, I was like, okay, it took 30 years. What's a few more months?
Exactly. But we're always learning and evolving, aren't we?
Yeah. And I really recommend school for whatever age,
maybe
for whatever
structure that it brings,
commitment. Maybe. I know. I think it's the conversations you have with people who are also learning. You know, they're there for a reason. They're there for an intention. They want to learn. And you get exposed to ideas that you wouldn't within your own choice of exposure. So when you go about your life, you do your thing, you're going to choose ideas that would resonate with you already. You know what I mean?
Or people. Yeah,
yeah, or mm-hmm. people. But in school, they bring up things that you didn't think you'd be interested in. But once they start opening up that Pandora's box, it's interesting. And then you're around other people and then you have conversations. I think it's the synergy and interaction of the people and the ideas that you don't get in any other way, not at work, not at home, only through school.
And you have, I just want to remind our listeners that you have just done so many things in your life. You've been, let not me count the ways, but you've been in media for sure. You're not a stranger to radio.
Right. It's been, 25 or 30 years on and off within the media, and much happiness and some disappointment, especially.
But when you were talking about radio, what did you do in the business of radio?
Well, I started at Cube Radio when I was in my early 20s. That was my first, K-Big in LA was my first radio job. I worked in the research department, and then I worked at Cube 93 in Seattle when Charlie and Ty were there. And I worked in the sales and promotion department as an assistant, and
vital kind of fun
atmosphere. It was so cool. It was so cool. It was when it was privately owned.
Yeah.
You know, before it was corporate, and just the camaraderie, and, you know, it wasn't like WKRP or anything, but more like Chris in the Morning, maybe.
Yeah.
K Bear.
But not dissimilar, because certainly throughout my different stations that I've been at in my career since I moved to Portland and decided, well, I don't want to be in a coffee shop working or secretary. I'll go into radio because I liked theater and I liked music. And I thought, that's radio, isn't it?
It's perfect for you.
Sort of.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to it, but obviously. But so you did that kind of back end, not the front end of things, but the back end of what
And
goes
I did
on.
Have a couple of shows in radio. I had the Sunday morning public affairs show.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. I mean, it was fine. You know, I loved it because I got to talk to people. And
yeah, yeah.
I got to bring issues forward to the community, which is how I ended up doing what I do. I've always cared about bringing issues forward, whatever the medium.
Yeah, and looking at, I know that you just told me that it's time for you to upgrade or update your website. So I don't know what is horribly out of date, but I was looking at your marketing services as being kind of your new arm. Branding, helping people brand, helping tell their stories in a way that you have the skill set to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always done that. Even when I worked at the magazine, I did a lot of PR and client business. Like, I worked with Cascade AIDS Project and Thomas Bruner. He was one of my clients. And I've always had organizations that I've helped figure out what is their story and how they're going to tell it. So I've kind of always done that. I think the new arm is more of helping people create magazines because they have no experience. They have marketing people doing it, or alumni relations people doing it, or development people. And, you know, putting together a magazine is a very specific production and efficiency that people have no clue.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was reading, and I can see that you like different sorts of people, because you were talking in your most recent post, and maybe that's what you say you have to bring it up to date, because that was June, I think, and it was about a guy who is he divines people, or
yeah,
I mean, just insane. I mean, I would have never thought to talk to anybody like that. How would you even find him? Did they come to you? And to tell me what exactly he is.
So he is a friend of a friend of mine, a woman named Sandy Serling, who I adore. She's just the sweetest, most interesting person. And she had brought him up to me as a resource. And because she knew I loved telling stories and had a unique way to tell stories, she asked me if I would tell his story. And she wanted to get his story out to a more mainstream audience. So she asked me to interview him and tell his story, and I did. And what was interesting, it's the first time I had something posted. It was in front of a million and an eight whatever people on his site. And you know, I felt like I'd been on the Huffington Post that day. Of course, there's millions more on Huffington Post. But the idea is that it was very widely spread. They liked it.
Yeah.
So that
yeah.
was cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. That and because he's not mainstream, just quickly, what is it that his specialty is?
He does healings and readings, and he works in more of a quantum physics realm of blueprints. And
who doesn't love that?
Yeah, I mean, physics, it's hard to explain, right?
Yeah, physics is one of my favorite things next to the other favorite.
Poetry, music, yeah. dance, theater.
All that stuff, yeah. Physics is going to have to take a step back, Brian.
Right.
Brian May, Dr. Brian May.
Right.
You know. But anyway, so that was interesting, is that there's a lot of interesting kinds of articles. It's fun to look through your blog, and we'll be sure to post that so that others can see what you're
Thanks.
Up to and the different kinds of things that you've gone through your life. I've met a lot of women who've kind of been through this sort of thing, you know, where they've had to reinvent and find
yeah.
themselves, and you found a tool through Merrill Hurst, or going back to school, essentially, is what really aided and abetted you, it sounds
And
like.
I will add that my supportive husband, because I think
you can give his name a shout out.
Mark. I think that adds a lot, too, because there's a lot of times where you have relationships in your life. They could be friends, they could be family, they could be spouses, where there's a lot of expectations on
right.
who you are in your process, and if you don't go according to their process or their timeline, they resent you, they judge you, they criticize you. And I mean, Mark, just in the darkest nights of my soul, never said, hey, get your together.
That sounds like your mantra, darkest nights of your soul. That's what you're going through right now.
So I'm out, coming out of it. But that's what my 2 years was about.
And the other thing that I've noticed since we've been chums ever since the first day I met you, now you have so many different passions, but I wanted to give a shout out to a few of them just to give people an idea that if you have an idea, it will come and you can give it out to the world.
Right.
It will come and you can embrace it. Tequila being one.
Definitely tequila is one of
Was that just a tequila? Was tequila like a favored instead of having a red wine? It was tequila. Tell me what you're doing with tequila.
So that's an interesting thing. I have a passion for educating people, especially women, about the amazing nuance of tequila, because everybody, and I'm not kidding, has a story about tequila that involves jello shots, ugly sombreros, and missing memories somewhere in Mexico.
Waking up on the front lawn of
right,
some house.
I have heard them all. And
not but me, but somebody. Yeah.
Tequila is none of those things. It's a very beautiful, rich, cultural, experiential spirit that if you learn how to sip and enjoy it, good tequila, and it doesn't always have to be expensive, but real tequila. Jose Cuervo is sugar and crap, and that's why you get headaches and hangovers. But if somebody sits with you for 20 minutes and explains the difference between a Blanco, a Reposado, Añejo, Extra Añejo, and patiently lets you sip and explore, man, I've changed so many people's opinions about it. And it's a wonderful, wonderful spirit.
So is there a name to this thing that you run? I mean, how can
It's called Tequila Star.
Okay, Tequila Star. Well, again, I'll make sure
right.
that we have all the Tequila Star.
That's just a passion thing.
Yeah, and
it's just something I love.
And then you invite people. I think I've had an invite for tasting.
Right. We do tastings. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll have liquor store events. We work on behalf of a single brand at the moment just because we love this particular brand. So we're ambassadors. We don't do it for careers or money. But, you know, a big opportunity came our way because of it. We're going to have an exclusive tasting dinner at El Gaucho in September.
Oh, that is very nice.
Only 15 people are invited. Wow. It's on their VIP list, and it's because of this one tequila that we...
Opportunities come if you open that door. It's a lesson that we've heard all the time. But, you know, unless you actually step through the door or put out your hand and bring it to you.
I think this is what I've been contemplating. Is it destiny or is it determination? And I think it's maybe both and neither.
Destiny and determination.
Right. Because sometimes things in life happen and we do things with them or we don't. And sometimes we work our asses off and we get nowhere. So, you know, sometimes I really think the paradox theme in my life, you know, it's everything, it's nothing. It's work and it's letting go. It's, you know, I mean, this has been an interesting concept for me to consider.
Oh, I was going to ask you just to be silly. What sign are you?
I'm a Taurus.
You're a Taurus.
I am.
Those are hard workers.
Yeah. They're hard workers. They're honest. They're loyal. Mm-hmm. They like nice things. That's why they work so hard.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. It's just I like to relax when I don't want my brain on overdrive. I like to relax with nonsense astrology.
There's no nonsense.
I like it.
There are some truths in there. I think.
I like to relax in that milieu. I do. I admit it.
Well, you know what? She's also reading poetry from 15th century poets. So you got to give her a break.
Yeah, please give me a break. Oh, man. Really? Well, we should have a separate time talking about poetry.
Right.
But that's for another time. I wanted to talk. So you've got Tequila Star.
Right.
And that's
hobby, passion, love.
Yeah. That both you and Mark do.
Right, we do it together.
Yeah, do it together. Your other more recent passions, and I don't know when I first started noticing that you were posting all these hummingbird images on Facebook, and I thought, did she just get a new camera? I got to talk to Jen. What is going on?
Yeah, that's a story too. In the brief time that we have, I will just say that it's brought me the most important lesson about unexpected joy. As somebody who worked so hard and had everything planned out and controlled, and you know, I saw myself as a certain way, as measured, as precise, and not in a analytical sort of way, but just in a orderly sort of way. Because when you run a business, you sort of have to. My business sale failed. That was a bust. Dark night of the soul. I was depressed for 6 months. I wore flannel pajamas. I mean,
You did all the top 10 things people do.
Right. I did them all. And then Mark had gotten me a hummingbird feeder, and he set it outside, and it was March, and it was like spring was coming, so there was blue sky. There were some clouds.
Was this just this year?
This was a year ago. So it would be 2 years mm-hmm. in this last March. So, and you know, in Oregon, Portland, when we get those first spring days, the daffodils are starting to peek through and blue sky.
Yeah, busting loose.
People are nice. So, but anyway, and the hummingbirds started coming around, and growing up in LA, I've never noticed hummingbirds, and I've known about hummingbirds, but I've never really noticed hummingbirds. And they were so cute and so tiny and just so sweet. And I started reading about them and learning about them. And then I started taking pictures of them, and they move pretty fast. I mean, and then I just started getting obsessed with like taking pictures. But it became something that was a very spiritual, soothing, no expectation endeavor for me. That is the one thing that has brought me more joy. And so I want to talk about like that simple joy, mm-hmm. just unexpected.
So with hummingbirds, I know that with some friends that I have down the gorge, they have a whole array of feeders and they sit right out front.
Right.
And the birds aren't very scared. They just fly in and they twitter out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends.
Can you access your feeders?
Yeah, if you're around them, they get to know you. Mm-hmm. They're just as curious about you as you are about them. And I've had these moments where I've sat there, and I swear to God, when I needed it, a hummingbird would come up, and he would literally sit there and look me in the eyes, and I would look at
him. Has he ever landed on your hand?
No, but close. But they look at me, and I could tell. It sounds so freaky and so kooky to me, but there was a serious connection. Like he knew, and I knew that he knew that I knew. And it was so strange.
Yeah, like with my pals in the gorge, Mark will sit there with his hand out when they're coming. They're about as far away as I am from you right now, and they come to his hand.
They do. They're very mm-hmm. smart. They're mm-hmm. very dynamic. They're very mysterious. They're very beautiful. They're incredible. The more you read about them, the more fascinating they are.
They're your joy animal.
I think so, for sure.
It sounds like it. I wanted to get just to a few other things before we have to finish out.
Yes.
It's been a great conversation. We'll have to renew this. I wanted to ask you just a quick take, real quick, on activation, resistance, movement. You know, where do you fall on what you... I mean, I know a lot of people like me fall on... right. If the sword was art, I would fall on the sword of art. That's what gets me through when things are unsure, when things are uncertain, you know, when I'm seeking succor, you know, that old word that just that will take me over, you know, take me across the bridge.
I think it's tough
when the world
is
confusing.
Yeah, I think it's tough right now because I think it's confusing in ways that we've never experienced before. We're disconnected from ourselves about how we feel about issues because there's so much stuff coming in. We can't even make sense because it's all so crazy. You think, okay, well, that was sort of crazy. Am I crazy for thinking that's really crazy?
And do we really need to fight that fight again? You know, I thought we fought for feminist action in the 70s. Why are we doing that again?
And I honestly,
or any number of things.
I never understood why feminism was even seen as a negative word. I mean, how did that happen? But to me, it's harder to find those things now and those channels and those vehicles and those groups that we can align with because we are so disparate in so many ways, in ways that we've never been before. So that, to me, is tricky. Being from the media, I see the circus moving around me, and it's moving pretty fast.
So what would be your suggestion to us? How to even start navigating?
I think just a couple of sources. I think you have to really just pick a couple of sources to stay informed. You can't bury your head, but I pick only one or two or three really credible news sources. And then
on a personal level?
On a personal level, you know, I take these hummingbird photos. I drink tequila, not every night, but I you know what I did? Here's the answer. Finding meaningful connections for you with people that share those same meanings. Because I don't feel like I have to have a bunch of people around me that I'm going to get in fisticuffs with because I have a differing point of view. Right now, my world is small. My all is small. And I'm going to keep it that way. I want to be around people that like art. I want to be around people that can discuss poetry. I want to be around people doing interesting, amazing things. I mean, it really comes down to those conversations, those simple conversations just around things that make you happy to get you out of that.
I know it's been said that we should try to, you know, seek out people who are of a differing mind. But that's tough right now.
I think it is, and I think it's okay. You know.
But on the other hand, I love diversity, and I do enjoy finding myself with groups of, you know, be they from the Middle East or Mexico or whatever part of the world they're from. You know, my world can be pretty insular. You know, I'm a white woman, and it can be.
I think diversity is great.
But how to find that for yourself is not easy. You know, where to go to do it. I guess you have to put yourself out in maybe like a school situation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that school has helped. And I don't think I surround myself with everybody who's like me. I think I get plenty of diversity, but the platform of who they are and how they see the world has to be similar enough. Mm-hmm. I don't want to fight those battles.
Right.
I don't need them.
Yeah. And, you know, finally, when we finishing our conversation here, Jenna, I wanted to ask you, what's next? There's got to be a new page that you can see turning right now. What is it? Can you tell us a clue?
Sure. It's a little vague, but here it is. I want to put together a book about hummingbirds that's going to include my photos and my sort of narrative about the evolution of learning about myself through them.
Kind of telling your story.
A small portion of it. I don't want it to be about me. I want it to be about the experience that I went through and how I found joy. And in this book will also be facts and science around what hummingbirds are. And then I want to include lore and myth from around different cultures of how they view hummingbirds. So it's going to have a little bit of my story, my photos, and then some information about hummingbirds and then how hummingbirds are viewed around the world.
And it sounds like you'll have to be going around the world to talk to people.
wouldn't that be nice?
And that is a proposed project for this next year?
Yeah. I'm working on a book proposal now. That's my project, my senior project that has to culminate at Merrillhurst is I had to pick something and I had to do 25 pages of something anyway, so I thought I might as well do a book proposal.
Well, there it is. That's your next page. That's your next road.
Here I am. Well, I haven't done it. I mean, I'm working on it, but I'm not really working on it, so I got to start working on it.
I figure if it's in your head, it's going to happen.
I don't know what I'm so afraid of. It seems like it's such a big deal, but I just need to do it. There it is.
Well, we'll check in with you next year and see how things are going.
Thank you. Hopefully you'll be able to buy a copy or sign a copy or
thanks, Jenna.
Give copies out.
Great catching up with you.
Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
That was communications professional Jana Lopez speaking with contributor Inessa Anderson. You can learn more about Jana by visiting her website, janalopez.com. Next up, this month's She-Ra Solution. It's a monthly biography about women, past and present, hosted by Kristen Thiel. Its title is inspired by Maria Theresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl, published in The Atlantic. On today's segment, Kristen shares some information, some life stories about two women, Zaha Hadid and Sarah Ehrman, two women whose backgrounds are often considered oppositional, but both worked outside that expectation.
Zaha Hadid was born in 1950 in Baghdad, a modern city bustling with big ideas. Her family had big ideas too. Her father led a progressive political party that advocated for secularism and democracy in Iraq. Even the Catholic school they sent her to encouraged diversity and inclusivity. The nuns taught kids who were Muslim, like Zaha, Jewish and Christian alike. Zaha went on to major in math at the American University in Beirut, and then attended the Architectural Association in London. There she was encouraged to trust her strange experiments in design, for which she would become known. Her buildings at turns fold and collapse in dramatic swoops toward the ground and shoot at angles into the sky, seemingly defying gravity. In addition to always being a working architect, including running her own 400-employee firm, she taught at several prestigious institutions around the world, though she saw it not as teaching, but as inspiring people. Even her classmates were inspired. Yasmin Sharif was a classmate of Zaha's, a few years behind her in architecture school. She wrote, "Very few people realized the misogynistic, racist, and anti-architect environment Zaha had to navigate in Britain. For Muslims, minorities, and women, Zaha is a shining torch beaming into the dark minds." When Zaha was an architecture student, only 6% of architects were women. 40 years later, that number was just 24%. So she was always an outsider, and outspoken about the injustice in her profession. "My work is not within the accepted box," she said. "Maybe because I am a woman, also an Arab. There was a certain prejudice about these things." More than once, people attacked her designs and process. In response, she sued, she firmly corrected the press, she even walked out once in an interview because of it. "Don't ask me a question if you don't want me to answer," she said. "Let's stop this conversation right now." Through all of this, and despite how weird her buildings were, she was genuinely popular. In 2015, Zaha won the British Reba Gold Medal. She was the first woman to do so, nearly 100 years after suffragette Ruth Lowy forced the Architectural Association to accept female students. She was also the first woman to win the Pritzker Architecture Prize in 2004, one of the world's top awards. She'd completed only 4 buildings at that time. That's how impactful her work was. Zaha's professional vibrancy translated to her personal life. She wore spectacular outfits and celebrated her birthday lavishly. She was honored with a Google Doodle in 2017. The press said that to attend one of her dinner parties was to experience a gathering such as Dorothy Parker's. In March 2016, she died in Miami, way too young, only 65 years old. A little over a year after Zaha died, another great woman, also with a foot in the Middle East and also with wings spread across the world, died, though Sarah Ehrman was at a much more expected age for death, 98. Sarah was born Sarah Teitelbaum in 1919. Her Hungarian Jewish parents had fled persecution in Europe and found refuge in New York City. Sarah took up her family's daring progressive perspectives after years of childhood stories about the goodness of the labor movement. At age 15, she started attending a summer camp run by Marxist Zionists, alongside Jews of Palestinian descent. Though she was accepted into Barnard College, Sarah refused to complete the one credit in high school chemistry that they said she still needed. Instead, she went out marching, spending her time fighting for what she believed in the streets. A couple years later, she was married to Liebert Ehrman. Almost 30 years and 2 children later, they divorced. During her marriage, she both stayed home with her children and worked outside the home, Her first job was working with economists who were analyzing the impact of civilian aircraft accidents. Her role was tearing the perforated edges off their computer paper. But by 1965, she was in politics, serving as a legislative assistant to a Democratic senator from Pennsylvania. As an Arab-Israeli war threatened to erupt overseas, Pennsylvania's Jewish residents reached out to their political leaders, and they often started with Sarah, making her the voice of the Jews of Pennsylvania. She would work for two senators, help run George McGovern's presidential campaign, work on Bill Clinton's 1992 presidential campaign and aid his transition to the White House, and serve as deputy political director of the Democratic National Committee. She traveled extensively in the Middle East and met with heads of state on all sides of the region. Yasser Arafat, then president of the Palestine Liberation Organization, even gave her a present. Sarah spent decades working into her 90s as senior advisor to the S. Daniel Abraham Center for Middle East Peace, advocating for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She described herself as first a Jew, second a Democrat, and above all a feminist. In 1974, Sarah tried to talk her apartment tenant, Hillary Rodham, out of marrying Bill Clinton. Sarah offered to move Hillary to Arkansas when Hillary wanted to try out a serious relationship with Bill. Sarah used the 2 days and 1,193 miles free of distractions to try to dissuade her. She saw Hillary as a person about to really go somewhere, and Bill is going no further than being a small-town lawyer. For all her warmth, Sarah was famously strong-willed. Just as Zaha displayed fierce emotions, quick to praise and quick to stand up for herself, so did Sarah. For example, though she became one of the closest people, personally and professionally, to the Clintons, her politics felt the left of the Clintons. One of Hillary's speechwriters said, "She was this person who'd been around and would speak truth to power. She'd offer advice in the Middle East and beat them up if she thought they were doing something wrong." Both Zaha and Sarah died of heart issues. Zaha of a heart attack, Sarah of endocarditis. Considering how big-hearted and strong-hearted both of these women were, how much they generously poured into this world, there could be something poetic said about the tie that bound these women in death. But I'll end this with a reminder that what truly ties them together is that they both lived up to who they were born as well as living up to the even grander human beings they desired to be. That's the Shira Solution for September 2017. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
That was Kristen Thiel with this month's Shira Solution. To learn more about the women featured, check out the links on our show page by visiting kboo.fm and searching for The Politics of Living. Contributors Tave Fache-Drake and Brian Delaney return with another excerpt from their podcast, Peace, Love, and Soup. On today's segment, they talk with Ayurvedic's practitioner, Licia Schaefer, about eating for the season, the cooling benefits of watermelon, and Ayurvedic health. They also have a new correspondent, Coco, from the KBOO Youth Collective. Coco brings us really fun vox pop. Stay tuned.
We're so grateful to have with us here today in the studio, Licia Schaefer, an Ayurvedic practitioner based in Portland who does workshops and private consultation for those near and far. Welcome.
Hi, Tave.
Hi, Brian.
Hello, Licia. Will you please enlighten us about the wonders of living an Ayurvedic lifestyle? And what exactly is Ayurvedic?
Ayurveda is an over 5,000-year-old medical system from ancient India. It includes herbal medicine, food, cleansing, breathwork, and it's the sister science to yoga. So yoga and Ayurveda come from the same philosophy.
And you are a yoga instructor as well.
Yeah.
And you also do nutritional counseling.
Yeah. I found Ayurveda and realized like this encapsulates everything that I've, you know, kind of studied already and ties it all together and this whole approach to health.
Well, I know when I took your workshop, there was something really like, about it. Like, oh my gosh, this just all fits together. So would you talk to us about those three different body types and three different seasons, and then maybe talk a little about the season we're in, which I remember is Pitta.
Yeah, that's right. So there are three seasons in Ayurveda and three doshas or body types. And we have Pitta, like you mentioned, that's associated with the summer season, heat. Mm-hmm. So when we think of Pitta, we think of fire and heat, hot, light. And then we have the fall, winter, they're lumped together in Ayurveda, which is Vata. So this is cold, dry qualities of winter. And the elements associated with those are air and ether. And then we have Kapha, which is the spring season, the heavy, soft. And the elements associated with Kapha are earth and water. Kapha people are more slow and sluggish and solid and stable. And cinnamon is great for Kapha because it's kind of zingy and it gets them going, spices them up. And that's the system behind Ayurveda. I've noticed for myself, I'm primarily Vata and Pitta. So in the winter, which is the Vata season, I'll have more Vata-related issues, dry skin, that kind of stuff. And then summer, I'll have more heat-related issues. So for myself, it's really helped me tune into what's going on and why it's happening, and then be able to do the opposite to balance it. So each of these seasons, as I just said, has different qualities and different elements associated with them. At first, when I was learning Ayurveda, I thought, well, how can we all be described by three doshas? That's not true, because each person is a combination of Vata, Pitta, and Kapha.
And that has to do with the season itself, but also a person's general constitution.
Right.
Or dosha. And then in this season, mm-hmm.
summer, we're kind of going to talk about Pitta in this interview, and I have a lot of Pitta in me, so I'm pretty affected by the heat. Like, I'll get heat-related issues such as inflammation or headaches. So we are affected by the season because it carries that dosha, and if we are predominantly that dosha, we're more affected.
Ah,
yeah.
Can you guess what we would be?
I would say you're both predominantly Pitta.
And what makes you think that?
Pitta is everything medium, you know, medium musculature. Okay. And hair type. Pittas tend to have wavy hair or not as much hair. and driven. You guys seem to be both very driven.
There's a kind way.
Definitely in a kind way. But note to our listeners, Brian is handsomely clean shaven on top of his head. So
I naturally started balding at around 25. And hair started spreading in other parts of my body other than my head.
That's a very Pitta thing. It's your body type.
So we have these three different doshas, or three different body types, but it isn't that everybody fits into one of those. It's everybody is one predominantly, but then a different blending of the other two. Yes?
Yeah, that's well said. One of my teachers says we're a confluence of factors, you know, and each dosha has all of its factors.
The confluence of factors is concise.
Yeah, it is, right?
Something I am not known for.
It's the title of your new book.
What are the best ways to eat for this season that we're in?
So it's very intuitive, actually. Food's the coolest down. It's, you know, salads, cucumbers, cilantro, lime, coriander, berries, melons. Rose is really cooling in the summer. White rice, chicken, almonds, licorice.
Watermelon?
Watermelon, exactly. Anything with water. Yeah. Dairy, actually, ice cream is pretty good for the summertime. Yeah.
Okay. It's great to know that. Sometimes we think of these other healthier ways of living, and people immediately think no gluten, no dairy, no whatever. So it's very enlightening and refreshing.
And that's what I love about Ayurveda also is you can't say no gluten and no dairy for everybody, because actually for some body types, those foods are good if they're able to digest them properly. Mm-hmm. And it's good to eat wheat in the winter in Ayurveda because it's very grounding, and the winter season is kind of described as very airy. Mm-hmm. You're up in the air. So you feel anxious and erratic. So the wheat helps ground you. You know, if you're eating locally from your region and you're eating what's in season, nature's providing you with the foods that are going to cool you down.
So when in doubt, eat what's local and in season, and you're probably not going to be too far off track.
Exactly.
So we're talking about cooling tips for the season. What are the benefits of watermelon?
So watermelon, it's a sweet fruit. So in Ayurveda, there are six tastes: sweet, sour, salty, bitter, astringent, and pungent, sort of similar to our Western tastes. But there's three that are considered cooling for the body. Those are bitter, astringent, and sweet. And watermelon, or any ripe fruit, is going to be sweet. So great to eat now, and they're in season, of course.
Can you talk to us about the Ayurvedic way to eat fruit?
One of the rules Ayurveda has is to eat fruit away from meals. So either an hour before meals or an hour after meals, or preferably as a snack by itself. And in Ayurveda, they say that the biggest meal is in the middle of the day. And here we talk about having a good breakfast, and that is true. Yeah, eat a good breakfast. Don't be depriving your brain of energy in the morning. And I grew up in England too, and we did this. So I'm sure it's not just in ancient India, but if we're going to, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but talk about a watermelon soup, that would be a really great summer dinner item, because we want our dinner to be light, not eating heavy at the end of the day, and it's by itself. It would be a nice little just light dinner item.
You really don't want to tax your digestive system during the summer.
Yeah, that's true.
Said, yes. I'm going to get out my gold star right now and put it right on your little bald head.
It's true, yeah. So our bodies are already naturally very hot in summer. We're retaining heat, and we don't really want to build a lot more heat by making our digestive system work a lot. Like eating foods that are already ripe, fruits and vegetables, you don't have to create as much digestive fire. In Ayurveda, we say digestive fire. And
so just in the winter months, then you need to eat warm foods to warm your body when it's cold.
Right.
Okay. Not to go off on these tangents, but I used to get really sick before I figured out food was medicine.
Yeah, a preventative medicine.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was acupuncture was saying, why are you eating salads in the wintertime? You need to be eating warm, cooked food. And like, well, I just don't cook too much. And that's what kind of led me to the soup world. That's when I started making soups. And I did. I made myself healthier.
Great.
Yeah. Yay. And here we are.
And here we are making soup podcasts.
Lovely.
So do you have a refreshing watermelon soup recipe?
I could concoct one on the spot, maybe. I love it. Okay. I'm thinking other cooling things like mint and lime and cucumber could possibly go in there. Okay. What do you think?
Mint, super refreshing. It sounds like it'd pair nice with the melon, so I love that. And citrus, would you go lime or lemon?
So lime is cooling, but lemon's actually kind of pitta provoking. Oh. So
we'll do lime.
I was thinking, what about jicama?
I have a jicama story for you.
Well, I will say,
you know, that's going to be good when someone says that.
I love this idea of jicama, actually, because I love how crunchy it is. It's got like a little bit sweet, but at the same time, it's not overpowering.
Right.
What about taking some of the rind and like slivering up some of that and either garnishing it on top or mixing it through?
I love that.
And then, because we know that you can also roast and salt the seeds, what about like sprinkling those on top?
That sounds delicious. I think you have your soup right there.
Okay.
I love that we just throw this together.
And then no one can be calling this a smoothie at that point.
You know, I thought of something else. I read recently that watermelon rind is really great for rashes, which is another, you know, heat pitta thing. So just rub it on because it's that cooling.
Yeah, like yellow.
Do you know bananas? It's the peels. Work the same way for burns. My friend, Baker Dan burnt himself. Yeah.
Poor Baker Dan. We had Baker Dan as a guest on our March episode.
Did he burn himself?
He did
not that episode.
Oh, thank heavens.
This is a more recent thing.
When you mentioned the bananas, that's also reminding me, you were recently on a trip to Cuba.
Oh my gosh, I was.
They have bananas there? I'm kidding.
Yeah, you better be.
Well, I had read about a variety of watermelon called the Cuban watermelon.
By
any chance, did you taste it when you were there?
I did have watermelon there, actually. Yeah, and it was pink with black seeds. Everything was fresh from people's gardens, so it must have been like a true Cuban watermelon, I imagine.
And then you had mentioned to me that place you stayed.
Yeah, funnily enough, we stayed with a family in the countryside, and they had an Airbnb, and they called them Casa Particulars there. And their Casa Particular was named Watermelon Wonderlust. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I got the email from Tappy when I got back, and we're doing watermelon soup. And we're like, hey.
I love synchronicity. I love that. That's so good.
You have a workshop coming up in September.
I do.
Tell me what the focus of that is.
So it's really exactly what we're talking about, how to cool down, release all that heat that's built up over the summer and not carry that over into the winter and have it cause a whole host of winter health problems. Yeah, so I'll be talking about that and some different food, yoga, breathing exercises we can do to cool down.
Do you have any other tips or tricks like that for the summer month that we're in now?
Yeah, there's a fun one. We could try it together right now, actually. It's a breathing exercise, pranayama. And what you do, you stick out your tongue and then curl your tongue
What if you can't curl your tongue?
Okay, so if you can't curl your tongue, then clench your teeth together. Like you're biting into a cucumber.
All right, I want to do the teeth clench as a thing.
So on your next inhale, you inhale through your curled tongue or your clenched teeth. And then pause for a second at the top of the breath. And then exhale through your nose. All right, so if you do this 5 to 10 times, 3 sets of that every day. And that's very cooling for your body. Can you feel how the air is cold through your tongue or your teeth?
I can.
So we can do that whenever we want to cool our body down.
Anytime. Actually, it's great if you're feeling aggravated, frustrated. All those things are very pitta related. Yeah. So cool yourself down.
And then what else? Is there maybe a simple pose or something as well that one could do?
Well, any kind of twisting pose is great for releasing heat in the body, because as we were talking about, pitta lives in the digestive system. Mm-hmm. And when you're twisting, you're wringing out your digestive organs, your liver and your spleen and your small intestine. So, if you're just sitting in the chair and you kind of reach kind of your head to the sky and twist to the right or left in your chair, hold for a few seconds.
It's like radio yoga.
Radio yoga, Exhaling is when you're really releasing heat from your body too. So really exhaling, like as you know, on twisting, you exhale in yoga.
I
love it.
You can do that on the ground. You can do it standing up and use your arms, do it in the chair.
So you're like wringing out your body. Yeah. You have a workshop coming up in September. Tell people where they can find out more about that, as well as if they want to get more information about you and the work you do.
So for the workshop, the Sou'wester has a website. It's sou'westerlodge.com. That's sou'westerlodge.com. There's an events calendar there, and you can check out my event happening September 6th. And then a former classmate of mine, Ayurvedic classmate and my mentor teacher, we are going to be starting a low-cost Ayurveda clinic. Mm-hmm. It will be, like a private session that's here in Portland, coming up in September, actually. And you can email me if you're interested in getting Ayurveda care at a low cost. So my email is lysschaeffer@gmail.com.
lysschaeffer@gmail.com.
Yes.
And then this clinic, would a person come in multiple times, or is it a group of people coming in at once? How does it work?
So the idea is you come in for a private session, and it would be with myself, my classmate, and my mentor. So you'll be getting group advice, and you'll do a initial session that would be 2 hours, and then 2 follow-ups that are 1 hour each, and more if you like, And we'd give you Ayurvedic tips, nutrition, yoga, herbal medicine, everything that Ayurveda offers.
Wow,
that's wonderful. What an opportunity for people that you're doing this in the Portland area.
Yeah,
thank you.
There's nothing like this here, so.
And you have a Facebook page also.
I do. Yeah, it's under my name, Elysia Schaeffer, E-L-Y-S-S-I-A. And then my last name is S-C-H-A-E-F-F-E-R. And I post stuff about Ayurveda on there, tips and what I'm doing.
All your classes and events and clinics will also be...
Exactly, on there. Yes.
And we'll have all that information on our blog as well as on our Peace, Love, and Soup Facebook page.
Good luck to you guys.
If you'd like to take a test to find out what dosha you are, there'll be a link on our blog. We did, and Brian found out he's half pitta and half vata. And I found out I'm half pitta, quarter vata, and a quarter kapha. Please visit us at kboo.fm/peace, love, and soup.
Yummy!
And now, Coco, our correspondent on the street.
My name is Coco, and I was asking people, how do you choose a ripe watermelon?
First, above all things, you slowly approach the basket of watermelons. Don't show fear.
I'm not really sure. Don't you, press on the end and see if it's, soft or not?
Well, how I know a watermelon's ripe is I thwap it. So I come up and I thwap a few of them, and the one that feels the most solid, the heaviest, that's the one I take home.
I also pick it up and see how heavy it is, because I usually use the really light ones.
How do I pick a ripe watermelon?
Mm-hmm. The knock test? You should hear the ocean in the watermelon. Like a water balloon sound, like a watery echo sound. And then I put it to my ear, and I knock on it again. I do this 3 times in different places. This is very important.
I can't tell if this is for practical advice or if it's a riddle.
I like to pick a ripe watermelon by turning it around to make sure that there's like a yellow or a white spot on the underbelly. And if it doesn't have a spot, then I know it's been picked too soon, and I definitely won't take it home from the grocery store.
I'm allergic, so I don't pick it.
How'd you pick a ripe watermelon?
Well, a ripe watermelon. Aren't you supposed to plunk it, like with your finger or something? And then if you hear like Iron Butterfly playing inside, then it's ripe.
Honestly, I'm not an expert on fruit, but in general, I feel like one with a nice colorful rind.
It should look like dark emerald ribbons over the watermelon. Now the baby sugar watermelons, those are much easier. You don't need to smell them, but I like to. I also like to pet them, and you pick them up, shake them, and then if I have a friend with me, I shake it in my friend's face to make sure that they also feel the vibes of the watermelon. It's not just me enjoying the watermelon, right? It's my friend, too.
And I also look at it in an inspirational kind of way to see what has the most alluring design, which one that speaks to you the most.
I guess that's how I'd pick a watermelon.
But you're not done yet. Then you have to look at the watermelon and ask it, is it okay for me to take you home?
Okay.
Right, I'm not done. And then when the watermelon says yes, you put it in your basket and go home. And then you cut it with a knife and you eat it. Now I'm done. The end.
And this is Coco for the KBU Youth Collective.
Thanks, Coco.
That was Tave Fashe Drake, Brian Delaney, and Coco of Peace, Love, and Soup. It's a podcast featuring a significant soup each month, along with culture, cooking, and conversation. You can check out the complete show by visiting kbu.fm and searching for Peace, Love, and Soup. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks so much to our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Anessa Anderson, Tave Fashe Drake, Brian Delaney, and Coco. Thanks to our guests, and also thanks to our technical editor, Liam Delta, and our webpage goddess, Vicky Mazzone. Thanks so much for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Denise Kowalczyk. Have a great day.